Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to 720 Degree Tennis. I'm your host, Bill Patton, and I'm going to play an episode that I had recorded a little while ago, but I'm going to replay it because the more I think about the iCoach that I've been using recently, the more it reminds me of my interview with Doug King, and I see a lot of the principles meshing between the use of something like that and then the way Doug is teaching in terms of leverage on the ball and balance and whatnot. So, you know, there are a lot of really key principles that mesh well with the use of that device and in the way that Doug teaches acceleration into the ball. So anyway, this is it's going to start rather abruptly due to some editing, but I'm going to go ahead and play that interview, and here we go with Doug King.
I am in the Napa Valley, right in the heart of the Napa Valley in St. Helena. I am the tennis director at a club and resort called Meadowood Napa Valley. Been here for 30 years and just loving life and loving what I'm doing here.
So does that mean people can come visit you on vacation?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So is St. Helena's really in the heart of Napa Valley? Is that really true?
Right in the heart, yeah. You've got the Valley course starts in the town of Napa itself and runs about 8 miles, ends up in the north end in Calistoga. So you run through Yountville, Oakville, Rutherford, and St. Helena is really just about in the center, and it's traditionally it's been recognized as kind of the center of the wine community itself. So it's a wonderful little area if you haven't been up here.
Wow, that's interesting. All right, so tell us a little bit about your origins and how you learned to play tennis.
Well, Bill, I grew up in the East Bay in Walnut Creek, and that was in the late 50s, early 60s when I got started. At that time, Walnut Creek was just a burgeoning suburb. I go back to that area right now. My parents still live there. I can barely navigate around all the traffic and things that are there now. But at the time, it was really a sleepy little suburb area. It was, just a great place to grow up. And I grew up in a family of five kids, two brothers, two sisters, and we all enjoyed sports, but we weren't a tennis-playing family. I played baseball, basketball, and football, just the traditional sports. My older brother, he was into the less traditional sports. When he got into high school, he was into gymnastics, and he got involved in tennis, and like any younger brother, I wanted to be like my older brother, so I gave it a try. You know, I just got a racket and hit against the garage door and just fell in love with it. I mean, I really just enjoyed the fact that I was, you know, involved all the time. It's an individual sport, there's nobody controlling your play. You play when you want, how you want. There's no coaches telling you what position to play, when you can play. There's no sitting out waiting your turn. So it was just a fantastic sport. So I just grew up on the backboard at a local school, took some lessons eventually just down at the community center, and just loved the game. So continued to play through high school. Eventually showed some promise, and at that time where I was, the Berkeley Tennis Club was the place for promising juniors to go, and when I got old enough, that's where I really kind of honed my skills at the Berkeley Tennis Club.
You know, it's funny that you should say hit against the garage door, because I did the same thing, and I wonder what percentage of kids hit against the garage door these days.
That's a very good question.
So, you know what? That's probably now the number one factor for the decline in American tennis. So, sorry, that's...
You know,
it's
an interesting topic, and we can follow that up a little bit as we talk about different influences. There's a fellow whose name is, I'm sure, is going to come up quite often, but his name is Torben Olerik, and he did a movie once called The Ball in the Wall, and he's had some sequels to it, but he basically looked at the nature of the game through the practice of the backboard. He went, this was shot in France, and he interviewed some of the greats, even people like Lacoste, Cochet, Laver, different people, and talked to them about their experiences with the backboard. And these people had great stories talking about the different backboards that they used and how they used them. And of course, as we find out more about Torben, there's more to the backboard than meets the eye in his own fashion. But it does highlight the fact that all these great players all were really schooled on the backboard. And I tell you, I don't know that kids use the backboards at all anymore. It's one of the most, kind of, as you say, the most revolutionary kind of changes you can kind of see in a sport, that something that was just an absolute staple of training has just all but disappeared.
Well, you know, that's fascinating. I had no idea we were going to start off like this in this conversation. But, okay, let's relate it to you have a basketball and you're by yourself, and what do? You go 3-2-1, he makes the winning shot, right? And
mm-hmm.
So you
bet.
You have this, you know, you do that 1,000 times when you're a kid, and then you get your chance, and hopefully you make that, but the rehearsal's there, the visualization's there. And I remember being hit the wall and thinking, okay, I'm going to hit a passing shot against John McEnroe on match point now, and I have to hit that cinder block to make it happen.
Yeah.
So, having played in East Oakland with Mark Manning, Mark had a great wall where he had targets set up on the wall, and there were assignments for players to score a certain amount of points before you could go and do anything else. So, that's a great thing. Maybe we'll come back to that.
I love also, if we can stay on that for just a moment longer and talking about just that idea of being with yourself and the imagination that's involved in that whole process. It's really something that I think it can be looked at in a lot of different ways, but that lone time you have and how the imagination is stimulated and how motivation is sparked in all of these different ways when you are by yourself, I think we see practice, and certainly a lot of practice, you know, needs to be guided. But then also the value of kind of that lone practice that triggers so many internal elements in our minds and our spirits that I think are really important to cultivate that maybe aren't developed as much as they used to be. I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I know Rick Macy talks about how he used to shovel snow in Ohio and his parents would turn the headlights on the car so that he could hit against the wall.
Okay,
the garage door, I'm sorry.
I mean, you better make that count, don't you, right? So shoveling snow in the cold and just to get an opportunity to hit against the wall, I mean, you got to make that count when that goes into it, right?
I think we got the most out of that we can get. who would you say were your coaches that were most influential during your formative years as a player? And what did they
contribute? Well, you know, you always go back, just to your very, very first teachers, the people that really, really got you started. And that was, there was a fellow by the name of Blackie Jones. You mentioned earlier when we were just talking off show about Jim McLennan. And
right.
Jim McLennan grew up in the same area nearby. I grew up in Walnut Creek. He was in Lafayette. But there was a coach out there by the name of Blackie Jones. And Jim may have mentioned him. But he was a real, real dedicated, just old-school coach. And he was very passionate, loved the game, and was a pretty hard-nosed guy. But, you know, that was kind of how coaches were back in those days, and it didn't seem uncomfortable. But I would say he was a great coach that got us started. A little bit later on, I met a fellow by the name of Gene Canton, who was a product out of the Berkeley Tennis Club, and a student of Tom Stowe's. And the way I got introduced to Gene was that my older brother, was playing and doing some tournaments. He played one tournament in Stockton at Oak Park, and I wanted to go and tag along and watch him play. And he was playing doubles, and he played against Gene Canton and Corky Meinhardt. And Gene was a big, pretty formidable guy, tall, strong guy, hit the hell out of the ball, could really crack the ball. And I remember he took a return of serve off his backhand and drilled it, hit my brother in the chest and knocked him down.
What?
Never forget that. That really impressed me, and it made a big impression, probably a bigger impression on my brother. But nonetheless, I soon found out that Gene was coaching out in the Concord area at some public courts, the Salvio courts out in Concord. And so I remember calling up Gene and saying to him, Gene, you don't know me. I'm a kid. I love tennis. And I want to know if it'd be all right if I can go over to your court and watch you teach and just pick up balls for you if you just let me sit and on the court and listen to you teach. And he kind of didn't like that idea, but at least we got introduced to each other, and it did start a relationship. I started taking lessons from him, and he was a student of Tom Stowe's. He was little different on some ideas than Tom, but definitely a product of the Berkeley Tennis Club school. And so Gene really brought me along a bit, and he really encouraged me, and he introduced me. He was the one who introduced me to the Berkeley Tennis Club. And so when I joined the Berkeley Tennis Club, and they had a program there for kids who were tournament players and were looking for better competition, at that time, Dennis Vandermeer was the tennis pro there. And Dennis was brought on in the mid-60s as an assistant to Tom Stowe. Tom was getting on in years, and he needed some help, and he hired Dennis from South Africa. And Dennis was a very, very engaging, very enterprising, very dynamic, and a bright guy and a good coach. And so I worked with Dennis during my early years at the Berkeley Tennis Club. And that was great fun. He was a really good coach, but he was just so busy. At the time, he was coaching with...
Okay, well...
So at that time, Dennis was also very busy coaching some of the top women pros. He was coaching Billie Jean King, and then there were a number of other women pros who would frequent the Berkeley Tennis Club. So he was a really, really busy guy. He had started a company with Billie Jean King called Tennis America, and he was expanding all over the place. So Dennis was a great coach, but he was just so occupied with so many different things that he was a bit distracted. In any case...
Would you say that Tom Stowe influenced Dennis Vandermeer? I mean, do you see traces of Tom Stowe stuff in the formation of PTR?
Definitely, yeah. I think that Tom had a big influence on Dennis, and I think Dennis would admit that Tom wouldn't have it any other way. You know, if he brought in an assistant, that assistant was going to teach the way that Tom Stowe taught. You know, so I think that anybody who came into Tom's sphere was mightily influenced by him. He was just a very powerful personality. And certainly if you came to work for Tom as either a coach or or as an assistant coach or as a student, you know, you were going to do things the way Tom Stowe wanted them done. That was just the way it was. So I'm sure that Dennis was quite influenced by Tom, and I definitely see that in the techniques as well.
And move more into the philosophy and what are the principles, because I think a lot of times people want to hear about the what was taught and how did it influence the game and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So if there are some pertinent historical items, continue. But let's try to get to the meat of the subject as much as we can.
Well, just in my own personal development, the thing that always kind of struck me in my own experiences, personal experiences, is that, I had in my game certain strengths and certain weaknesses. In my case, I had a really strong backhand and a weak forehand. And so I never really could resolve that. I had good coaching. I had Tom Stowe. I had Dennis Vandermeer. I had and I worked very hard. So that kind of formed the basis of my approach to the game. Why is it that somebody who is good on one side can't repeat or duplicate that same level of success on another side? I mean, you're the same person. You have the same skill levels. So what makes that happen? And so that always intrigued me. With all the coaches that I went to, all of the coaches wanted to change my backhand, but never really did anything to my forehand. That didn't make any sense to me either. So I became very suspicious about the whole approach to things. And then I think later on in the 70s, as we started to see an evolution in the game, really that I think started with computers had a lot to do with it, I believe. I think motion picture development had something to do with it, and you could say sports science. And I think that also this coincided with the emergence of Bjorn Borg, who had just an enormous effect on the game. But I think that people started to see the game differently. In the old days, of course, it was always kind of a very linear, through-the-ball kind of approach, that this idea of controlling the ball was by, just driving through the ball. And then, we saw an emergence with Borg in particular, but he certainly wasn't the only one, but Laver really kind of, I think, initiated some of these things as well. But you can go back to even to Bill Johnston in the 30s and so on and see examples of some of these things. But the fact is that people started to use different grips and different stances, and really I think that it was the forehand that started to change more than anything else. So then our way of approaching the game also started to change with a new stance. Really, I think kind of more of an open stance idea changed us from this step into the and hit through the ball to much more of a horizontally or a vertically planed kind of a game, which we refer to as a windshield wiper effect now. But it really changed it from this linear through the ball horizontal game to much more of a sideways-oriented vertical plane.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is, in my opinion, the way I would look at it, is this is really how all sports evolve as speed is introduced into the game. If we look at baseball, if you look at golf, it's much more of a sideways-oriented swing path that involves rotation as opposed to swinging through the ball. Now, you see, I don't like that phrase, swinging through the ball, just because it makes me go back to this idea of this linear path straight from behind the ball, through the ball, and out to the target, which is, I think, exactly what good players don't do. And when I say I don't like the idea of hitting through the ball, it's not that I don't like a follow through, and I understand that there's an action after contact, but it's not through the ball nearly as much as what people in the past have actually kind of taught and tried to apply. So I think that's really been the change in the game, is that in fact we don't hit through the ball. And I would say that we in fact do what they say in other sports, and that is turn on the ball. I would say that we really, in my opinion, don't understand really the nature of what contact is.
Let me snatch you for a second here, Doug. I'm a big fan of Oscar Wagner, and he's been on the show, and I think sometimes people misunderstand him a little bit, but when he talks about the finish, he talks about the hand coming up and across. Mm-hmm. And when you're then pulling the racket back towards you at the end, that really facilitates acceleration going up and out. So how does that fit with what you're saying, or not?
Well, I would break the swing down into a number of parts. This we can go into a little bit more as we go along, but I think that we have a speed element in some strokes, we have a contact element, and we have a drive element, and then we have a recovery element. I think that what most people call the follow-through, I would call the recovery. And I would say that there is a speed element going into the touch, and then there is a contact on the ball, which I would constitute kind of a hold, and then I would consider the next thing to be a drive, which is more of a muscular push and turn of the ball. And with that muscular push and turn, the turning action rotates things from the inside of the ball to the outside of the ball, and it rotates the racket back across the body. And then finally, there is a rather passive recovery part of the stroke. This is very much like swimming, for example. If we look at a swimming stroke, you know, there is a speed element of the hand when it's outside of the water. As the hand gets into the water, it turns so that it actually creates resistance with the water. That, to me, is the catch. That's the hold. And at that point, when you establish resistance with your contact, the next phase is the drive. And in the case of swimming, there's a kind of a muscular pull on that point of resistance. That point of resistance should be in a place of leverage. So we're trying to establish a contact, which is a point of resistance at a point of maximum leverage. And then at that moment of contact, there's a drive which occurs, which is a more muscular action. In the case of tennis,
let me interject here for a second, because I think I have some follow up on that, and I have two things I'll throw at you, and you can answer them in the order you wish. So in my mind's eye, I'm thinking that the throwing of medicine balls while mimicking a stroke can help train a significant portion of that.
And sure, then, I would say that constitutes the drive element. Now, you know, there's a speed element which is much more whip-oriented. So if, let's say, we're hitting a very powerful forehand, the beginning part is quite loose and flowing, and it is to generate speed, so there's a whip quality to it. Now, if that whip action is just let loose, we say it becomes too whippy or too swingy, and you just hit the ball over the fence.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's a what we call kind of a drive on the ball. The drive element is really what kind of takes that speed and actually controls it. It takes a speed element, but it then converts it into more of a controlled element. Because you think of driving, what do you think of? Well, you think of driving a car. It's really a steering. To me, in my vocabulary, I would say driving has a very strong directional or steering component to it. That's what driving the ball is.
That leads me to my next question, and that is in regard to how people, because of their different places of strength and different amounts of flexibility and different grips and stature and all of that, are going to have a different place where they're going to have generate the most possible resistance to create that steering.
Absolutely. You know, you've got somebody like Fabio Fognini, who I just love watching play, but he's got like the tiniest strokes, just tiny, but he just crushes the ball. And he's a powerfully built, stocky guy, much like Agassi was very similar. You know, he had very, very compact strokes, Agassi, relatively short backswings, you know, and very kind of tight to the body contact position. But very powerfully built, so he had a very strong drive component to his stroke. And you've got players who are much more whippy and lanky and things like that. Djokovic has, you know, much more of a whip kind of dimension to his game. Nadal, I think, certainly he's powerfully built, but at the same time, you know, he's pretty flexible. And he's pretty loose with his swing. I would say Federer, of course, is very handsy, and is a bit, you know, he lacks a little bit of the drive component on his stroke in comparison to somebody like Del Potro, of course, who's a little bit thicker with his stroke and kind of lays on the ball a little bit more. So, you know, each of these guys, they're built differently. They have different kind of personal makeups just psychologically, too, and so on. And it all influences. And certainly their grip, too. I mean, a guy could be a stocky-built guy but have a certain grip that just makes his hand a little bit lighter and whippier, however that might be. All of those things influence somebody's style for sure. But I think that, nonetheless, you know, every stroke is composed of certain elements. And how those elements are blended, you know, does define somebody's style. But nonetheless, I think that all the strokes can be broken down into those components. I think the follow-through is really the thing that is probably the most misunderstood and probably, to me, the most confused and confusing element of the game. It's the part of the game that kind of steers people off course the most, just because there's so much emphasis put on the follow-through that it, I think, diminishes the attention that needs to be brought into the actual contact itself.
So what do you mean by emphasis on the follow-through, and are there particular forms that people try to mimic or try to force to happen, or, you know, where does it go wrong?
Well, I think that first of all, I think that a lot of this stuff, it originates in just our human nature. And I think as humans, we're very end-oriented. You know, we are doing things with always an end in mind. When I engage in an activity, it's usually not to particularly just get engrossed with the activity, but to achieve some end, to get to some result. So, you know, the end of our stroke, we tend to put a great deal of focus on that because that's where we're ending up there. And so our mind gravitates towards the ending. Our mind is always programmed ahead of our bodies. This just allows our mind to prepare our body for what's coming up. And so our mind is trained and really kind of designed to be ahead of the body. So it's completing tasks before the body has really had a chance to get there. So again, there's all of this hardwired nature within ourselves to kind of look at the end result, which is where the ball is going, which is where I'm ending up with my stroke. And I think also as we're trained, there's so much emphasis on the end because, number one, it's so easy to identify. When I train somebody, and I say, okay, hold your follow-through, and what I'm doing right there is checking certain things, but I'm also putting in that student's mind this emphasis on the follow-through. So they're now putting their focus on the follow-through. And so, of course, you know, every time you do that, you are reasserting kind of this already kind of hardwired bias towards going to the end. And I think that really what we need to do as we develop is we get more and more focus and attention and real more complexity or nuance into the most critical part, which is the contact itself. So yeah. Great players, you know, are much, much more attuned to the ball at contact, holding it longer, adjusting into it. You know, they just have so many kind of subtle, nuanced ways of relating to the ball, whereas a lesser player is focused much more on the follow-through. So I think that you know, you go around and walk around a tennis court and listen to players as they talk to themselves. It's always, oh, I didn't follow through, and so on. And really that had very, very little bearing on the success of the stroke. The fact is, if you hit a ball really well, your follow-through is going to be good. But if you follow through well, it doesn't necessarily mean your shot's going to be good.
Right.
So, you know, it's. I think it's not where our focus should be. I like to do a lot of drills with people, having them.
Yeah, I agree with you that people are fans of a certain tennis player, and then they will go and they will try to mimic the thing that they can see, which is that characteristic follow-through, because they can't really see the contact very well.
Yeah, so it's hard to see the contact.
You are a little bit better. Maybe, you know, I think it would be great for people to, you know, go look at Tennis One, go look at the super slow motion video, and really take a close look at what's really actually happening, and take your advice and look at that contact point, because it's the most critical moment in tennis, without a doubt.
Again, if we go back to the idea of contact, that I actually would look at sports like skiing, for example, that, you know, what does somebody use a ski pole for? You know, that's used to establish a contact point that the body turns on. It's a leverage point that the body, you know, and I think that in very much the same way, we have contact with a tennis ball that can be used in a very similar fashion that a skier uses a ski pole for. And this is where I would differentiate between stable and unstable contact points. I'd both differentiate between them, but I would also take note of the similarity between those things as well. A ski pole is a stable contact point. That is, you're really turning on the earth itself. That pole is connected to the earth. It really is the earth. So you are turning on a stable contact point. Baseball players and golfers, they talk about turning on a ball also. I think that tennis players, you know, we talk about hitting through the ball, and we talk about the follow-through. But I think that this notion of actually trying to understand the resistance between the ball and the racket and how we can manipulate that moment of resistance of an unstable contact point. Again, if we go back to water, or if we look at rowing, for example, what rowers are told to do is that when the blade of the oar is turned to create resistance in the water, just like you would turn your hand to create resistance in the water, they're told to imagine that all the water turns to concrete. Everything turns to concrete out in the water. And so they're trying to maximize that moment of resistance. And so what they do is get a very dynamic drive. That is, the body can really fire on this moment of resistance at exactly the right time and exactly the right space of leverage and timing and so on. And water is also an unstable contact, but it's much, much more stable than a tennis ball. So now we look at a tennis ball and we see that as a highly unstable contact point. And there's not a lot of resistance that's created between the ball and the racket because the ball is so light. But
I'm a little confused here. So how defining stability now, and so how is a tennis ball less stable than water?
Well, water is much denser. So if I put a blade or if I put my hand or whatever in water, it's just like if you put your tennis racket in water and tried to swing it, it's going to be very dense. You know, it's going to strain your body to try and move it in that water. If you put your tennis racket against a wall, again, the wall is really connected to the earth, so it's totally stable. It's much stronger than you are, so it's not going to move. In fact, you're going to move off of the wall. And in the same way, the water, when it's used right, you know, you can actually move yourself. That's what rowers try to do. They try to move themselves off of the water. And I think that tennis players, you know, like we always talk about just hitting through the ball, like we're just going forward. I think really great tennis players actually, what I would say is square themselves up off of the ball. They turn and they straighten themselves, what we call square up, on the ball.
Yeah. Interesting.
You know, so it comes back to kind of these new ideas about whether you want to call it a windshield wiper thing or new stances or new grips or all of these things, but it gets away from this very linear, very forward, back and forward oriented type of approach to the game. Our game is so much been in this back and forward orientation that mimics the path of the ball. And it's completely, to me, completely unsound in a physical property, in the way anatomically and ergonomically, the way the body works. It just is very unsound and very non-dynamic. So, again, I think that within the stroke, the tennis stroke itself, we are taking that moment of contact with the ball and actually, you know, releasing all kinds of energy on that point that has all kinds of elements to it, up and down, in and out, and back and forth. And, again, this is the nuanced complexity that I think great players show, that it's not just a forward, back and forward, horizontal kind of action that we're talking about.
Let me test one of my ideas because I think this relates to what you're talking about. One thing that I talk about with my players is that there are three axes of rotation in your body. And so, imagine Federer coming forward on a short ball with a short backswing, and he rotates on the front half of his body, front foot. You know, then imagine a player, the baseline, and the ball has so much force on them that there's no moving the body forward, but it's the rotation within the cylinder.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, you know, something that Djokovic and Nadal do much more commonly than anyone else is the diagonal backwards move and then rotating off of the back foot.
Right, right.
You know, how,
exactly.
Does that fit with what you're talking about?
Absolutely, absolutely. You really have three planes of rotation and extension. You know, there's up and down, there's back and forth, and then there's what I would call in and out. Now, the volley, for example, actually has more of a back-to-forward body shift to it. You know, you step into a volley, and that weight shift going, you know, say, when I step into a volley, let's say I'm hitting a forehand volley, essentially, I'm making contact off of my right foot, and I'm a right-handed player. I'm essentially on my right foot in mid-stride, so I'm catching that volley with my left foot in the air and moving forward with my weight shift. But that's really not a powerful movement. It's really designed as a more just a guiding kind of more absorbent. Now, you compare that with a more powerful forehand stroke, which is more rotational. So you think of an ice skater spinning. See, that has much more speed than stepping forward, just stepping forward. So
right.
A volley is really a more directional weight shift going, just staying a little more sideways, going more just back to forward with very, very little to no rotation, whereas a ground stroke may even have a backwards weight shift to it, as you were saying with Djokovic, but there's rotational movement, either stepping back or stepping forward, but it's the rotational movement, again, like we call it angular momentum, because it's not going in a straight line, it is going in a spinning angle, actually, that is actually faster, it creates more speed. It's not as directional, you can't necessarily guide a ball. So, again, you have all different kinds of ways of shifting the body. And, again, we're just so, I think, just trained in a certain vocabulary, a way of describing things that really goes back to Joel old school, of just stepping into everything,
right.
That I think it really blinds us to other types of movement that actually can be much more dynamic.
Okay. This is very, very deep, and I think there are going to be some people who really appreciate the depth on this. I'm getting the feeling that I would recommend to people that they listen to this particular show more than once. And, I would hope that, when we get to the end here, that you know, people can feel free to contact you and kind of flesh out their understanding. I would be interested in coming to, spend some time with you, maybe work on my game a little bit. But, you know, mostly as a way to then take that and teach it. Where do we go from here? Because you've got about 5 minutes left here, and that was...
Boy, that went fast, huh?
Yeah,
well,
amazing.
You know, I think that, the thing that really, you know, kind of interests me even more than the dynamics that we're talking about is more just the philosophy of even why we play tennis. You know, why is it important? What is it that makes us want to play tennis, and why is it of value to us? That to me, you know, we can talk about all these things about grips and weight shift and stances and all these different theories about how we use the racket, how we use the ball, all these different things. But I think deep down what we really also need to look at is why is this important to us? And I think it is important. And I think that it's important because, you know, there are things that we can learn about ourselves, and we can learn about, you know, just the world around us that can only be learned through these kind of experiential things, sport, music. I mean, these are things that we're never going to learn at a desk or through a book or in a lecture, that we're only going to learn, you know, by doing them. And
answer, Doug. I know why people do it. Are you ready?
Yeah,
I
tell me.
I have the answer. This is the answer. The answer is 487. You know what that means?
No, I don't. But tell me.
No, this is very important, and I tell kids this all the time. I'm like, kids, you know why you want to play tennis? And they go, no. I say it's because of 487 is the number of times you hit the ball on average in a match.
Huh.
I like this stuff. I'm a violent person, and I want to hit stuff. And I don't want to play baseball and maybe make contact with the ball 12 times and 8 of those are foul tips.
Yeah.
I want to crush the ball. I want to hit it. There's nothing like hitting a tennis ball when you have made perfect contact and had that effortless moment when things just went absolutely perfectly.
Yeah.
It's one.
Yeah, there's a truth there, isn't there?
Yeah. So I tell kids that all the time, 487. And then, oh, do you like to sit on the bench? Yeah, keep playing baseball. Go for it. So.
But it is that experience of hitting the ball perfectly, of really connecting with things that does have a resonance to our spirits, you know, that like, we go out and we play catch with our dads as kids and we throw the ball back and forth to our buddies. You know, we can do that all day long. I mean, it's, you know, you never tire of it, just back and forth and back and forth. And there's something that's just very pure about that. But I think that also, it makes me think of this movie. There was a great movie, what was it, 84, I think. It won the best picture, the Oscar for the best picture that year. It was called Crash. You remember that movie?
I did not see it.
Crash. It was, I think it was Matt Dillon and Sandra Bullock and Terrence Howard. It's a good movie, but it was all about how we crash into things. You know, and that we have biases in our lives. We prejudge things. We're just too narrow in our focus. We never stop to look and take a different perspective of things. But we just basically are very forceful, and we just crash through everything in our lives. And the movie was just basically saying, hey, learn how to look at things from a different perspective. Learn how to take your time. Learn how to move gracefully, but powerfully and decisively, but do it, you know, in a certain way and not crash into things. And, you know, you're talking about grabbing a racket or a stick, and, you know, what we're really doing is learning how to not hit things. If we hit a tennis ball, we're going to lose. We have to learn how to stroke it. And what we're really learning is how to take, you know, we grab a stick, and of course our first impulse is to hit something. But if we approach the game that way, we're never going to master it. We're never going to win. We're just going to be, we're going to be losers. So
that's a great comment, and I think that speaks really well to my former self. And you clarified what I really meant. So I really appreciate that. Let me throw another thing at you. I had an epiphany when I had this young guy working with me, and he was from the Philippines, and he's probably about a 6-0 level player, and really great young guy. And so anyway, I let him teach junior program at one point, and he was teaching the juniors about the difference between being active and passive.
Mm-hmm.
And then And then it hit me all at once, and I realized that it's an extremely important differentiation between almost every activity on a tennis court to know whether you're being the right level of active or the right level of passive.
Yeah, well, in a sense, I mean, that's what hand-eye coordination really is. You have a non-moving side, which is the eyes. Everything that comes through our eyes and our perception is really enhanced by non-action, non-movement, by being passive. And this is where good judgment comes from, is by taking ourselves kind of out of the action. And at the same time, we have this very active side. So that is really a redefinition of just what it means to have good hand-eye coordination, is this passive and this active side. I mentioned Torben Olrik earlier, and you know, he broke the game down into moving and non-moving, which is really, again, the same thing, kind of the hand-eye coordination proposition. You know, and really, you know, this is what we also refer to as thinking on our feet. And it's true in everything. You know, our minds are trying to freeze everything. They're trying so we can make good judgments. You know, if I can make everything stay still, my ability to judge things and extrapolate and make decisions is enhanced. But that's not how things work. And this is what I try to teach my kids, you know, people, is that your job as a tennis player is not to watch the ball. That's what the linesman's job is to do. Their job, and we put them in chairs and we teach them how to anchor themselves so they can do that. Your job as a tennis player is to play the ball. Learning how to watch the ball is something you're going to have to do, but it's not your job. So, again, I think there's an overemphasis even in just watching the ball. I think it gets people too freezed up or too frozen. And, you know, these things we tell people, they have implications that we don't understand. We think we're giving them good advice and saying the right things, but we don't fully understand the implications that they can have. And so I think language is another thing that's something that we really have to pay attention to.
Yeah, that's a whole nother hour on that.
So we've
reached the end of our time here, and even though we've gone past the hour, it's still the podcast is still taping, and that's fine. And so how would you put the most concise wrap on this conversation? How would you summarize this in five sentences or less?
Well, I think tennis is like nothing else and like everything else. I mean, it's a great way for us to learn about ourselves. It's a great discipline, and I think it's like everything in that respect, that we can learn these invaluable things about how things work by really applying ourselves in a very, very disciplined and thorough way, in a very committed way. On the other hand, tennis is just such an incredibly beautiful sport. It has so many more advantages. You talked about baseball and football and these types of sports. I think that tennis is unique in what it affords us in so many opportunities. And so I think that it is a beautiful sport. But I think that it really comes down to just applying ourselves well, and it's just a matter of finding passion. How does one find passion in the game? Because there are going to be obstacles. This is just part of the path of anybody who does something in a committed way. You're just going to run up against obstacles, ongoing obstacles and major obstacles, and it's only through passion, you know, that you're going to be able to break through those things. And so I think that it's important to rediscover constantly the beauty of the game on so many different levels, and to really understand why it's important to you, and to make it relevant in your life, that it's not just something that we do to win a trophy. It's not something that we do just to get a ranking and be better on the team, but that's not going to sustain you. It's got to be deeper than that, and so I think it's a challenge for everybody to really understand why the game is really relevant and important to them.
Great. That's a wrap. That's awesome. So could you give us some contact information so people could follow up with you and maybe come get a lesson or whatnot?
Sure. Sure. As I said, I'm at Meadowood Napa Valley, and I can be reached. My email is dking, K-I-N-G, at meadowood.com. So that's my email address. And the Meadowood site, you can see a little bit about Meadowood and see some of the tennis. I also have some of my videos that I've shot for Tennis One up on that site, and that's just meadowood.com.
All right,
so love to hear from your listeners and love to go over some of these ideas and any other things that they like to talk about tennis.
All right, very good. Hey, thank you so much for your time and for the very deep conversation. Have a great evening.
Thank you also. Thank you for all you're doing for the game. I really appreciate it, Bill.
All right, take care, Doug.
You too. Thanks.
That's going to be worth a listen or two. So... very deep stuff. I definitely think that Doug's got a very strong contribution to the understanding of how to play the game better. Maybe the stuff at the end may have been more important than the stuff at the beginning, because it is so important to know, why do you play this game? Why are you doing this? I mean, if you're doing it to seek self-discovery and learning more about yourself. I mean, there's so many opportunities for that to happen. So anyway, that's it for this show, and I will leave you with this.